from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. Nathan Englander won the Penn Malamud Award and the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the Academy of Arts and Letters for his story collection For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, which we talked about on Forum many years ago. His short fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and in both the Best American Short Stories and the O. Henry Prize Stories. He's also author of a novel, The Ministry of Special Cases, and his newest collection of short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, has been praised by a lot of A-list writers, Jonathan Lethem, Michael Chabon, Jennifer Egan, Dave Eggers, Jonathan Safran Foer, and the list goes on. He joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and it's been a long time, but welcome back.
It's so good to be back. It's really nice to see you.
Well, let's get right into it here. Why are you writing stories still? Philip Ross says, why write fiction? You've taken the torch from him and the mantle in many ways. But some are saying you really have to write a novel if you want to, well, have the readers that you need and all that.
I was going to say, and I was actually talking to Philip about hearing one of these shows, so I won't own taking the torch because you never know when he's listening. He was there was some other show he'd heard and taken to task for something like that. Anyway, but yes, he is a great influence on me, and I'm enamored and a huge fan of his work. But why stories? You know what? It's I guess we start out straight up existential. But the point is why anything is the point. I just feel like, you know, it's about when people talk to me even about why writer, I just feel like you should do whatever is closest to your heart. You know, people often make these safe decisions. Say somebody really, really just dreamed of being a trapeze artist and they took that job at Bear Stearns because they wanted safety and they wanted a retirement. You know, you could do something that makes you miserable for your whole life for safety and end up with nothing, you know, and I you know, just it's closed down. And for me, the idea, I really feel like everybody has the greatest chance of success in life doing what they want most passionately, like be the most passionate dentist or the most passionate accountant, whatever it is. So for me, at that, you know, this point in time, I was working on two other projects. I was working as a translator and working as a playwright. These two projects, you know, working at things that I do not identify myself as. You know, I am not a playwright or a translator. It just freed up my mind. Working in other forms freed up my mind, and I was able to refocus, and I just was awakened by the thought of how much I truly missed and love the short story. I love this form.
And so it ignites in you, and the passion is there, and you go with it. That's
yes.
Sort of the proverbial bottom line.
Yeah, and I think it's a really nice life, because every time you start, I mean, I'm full of terror and always panicked and the most neurotic person you'll meet. But about starting projects, whatever I am consumed with seems like the best thing in the world. You know, I will tell you that fiction is the supreme form because it is. But if we get to talking about the play, it will be like there is nothing like theater. It's the way I am with cities. When I was living in Jerusalem, it's the best city in the world. You know, then I'm in New York, like it's the best city in the world, wherever. So I feel like that excitement moves to
Madison,
the writing
part time. That's the best city.
And now I'm loving the Madison.
More left than San Francisco, I think.
That's what I was saying here. I was like, what a conservative city I've come to visit. I had no idea there was such a bastion of leftiness and recycling and open-mindedness as Madison in this world.
By the way, your pride in your having more terrors and more fears and more neurosis than anybody, you have a lot of competition in that. I mean, think about people like Richard Lewis and Woody Allen.
That's true.
So many of them are Jewish. In fact, you know, your work is Jewish, and this work is particularly sort of overladen with a lot about the Holocaust, particularly in the title story, but throughout the book. And I remember having a conversation with Cynthia Ozick where I said, the shadow of the Shoah keeps going on and on, even to your generation. Some would think your generation might have pulled the plug, so to speak, on it, but it's still there, isn't it?
That is... You're like, that's why I have this job. I was going to say, that's a wildly thoughtful question. You're like, I think about these things. Anyway, but the point is, it's a different refracted side of the short story question, why stories again. But I was very fortunate to get to spend the fall in Berlin about maybe it's 3 years ago now at the American Academy. And there I was living in this giant house that was, you know, built by a Jewish banker and then taken over by, I think, the SS Minister of Finance. It had these Jewish ghosts and these Nazi ghosts. And I was on Lake Wannsee, like where the Wannsee Conference, you know, where Eichmann was secretary, where they put the Final Solution into play. And I was thinking, you know, just And again, I feel bad for the Academy. They can never really have a conference there. You know, what they have to call it, like, the gathering. You can never really invite people to another conference on that lake. But anyway, the idea was, I was thinking about this, like, it's getting near 100 years later when you know, time moves. We'll soon be at a century. And I thought, this investment, we must remember, never forget, you know. And it was actually meeting the young Germans there who were, except for Orthodox Jewish kids or traditional Jews, I don't think I'd ever met. It's the way Jews dream of Gentiles remembering the Holocaust. So when I met people younger than me who were so invested in this memory, who understood its weight,
it's
who
all
felt
over
the burden.
Berlin. I mean, it's, yeah. You compare that, say, to Vienna, and
yes, right.
What an extraordinary dramatic difference there is.
Yeah. So I thought about what it is exactly that. It's people. There's tons of stuff about the Holocaust, but I think, you know, Anne Frank's in my title, but she ain't in my book. But it's more, I'm really interested and how memory forms, because that's the point. I'm an American kid. My family's been here a long time. I'm so deeply American, and I feel like a son of the shtetl. And I'm wondering, you know, it's that idea. I tell you right now, the Holocaust memory is important, but I only think that because I was educated to think that. And I'm interested in how memory and history makes us who we are.
But it's clearly not just, for many Jews, it's maybe one day, Yom HaShoah, or you know, when they, for you, it's always there, isn't it?
Yes. I think it was, honestly, that's the point of writing. I think it's getting comfortable with your own head. I think that's a big part of this book, was not only ownership of material, or I'm sure we'll get to it, but touching on the Carver story, but even getting comfortable with one's own obsession. I mean, the way I've been pops into my head lately, I think, did anyone let Nabokov babysit after he wrote Lolita? You know what I'm saying? You have to write what's in your head. And for me, it's this, I just sort of gave in there in Berlin and think I'm just nutty for Nazis.
Well, here's an opening paragraph of a story, which, by the way, takes its title from a collection of Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, which was not his title. It was Gordon Lish's title, by the way, as I'm sure you
probably
know.
I love that fight.
I'd like to get these little footnotes in there. But they're in our house maybe 10 minutes, and already Mark's lecturing us on the Israeli occupation. Mark and Lauren live in Jerusalem, and people from there think it gives them the right. And you think about Mel McGinnis in the beginning of that famous Carver story, saying he's a doctor and therefore it gives him the right. So you've sort of transposed it. You've taken the idea of a physician having a status that allows him to speak with authority and put it on an Israeli.
Yeah, I was going to say, so this story, and it's, I call it, you know, it's the Anne Frank game, or the Righteous Gentile game, or the Who Will Hide Me game. But I've had this, it's when you put something out in the world, it's really overwhelming to me. But to hear back from all the people, and not just in a Jewish way, you know, every ethnicity, people play this game. It's a really primal game. I had no idea. I thought in my world, my sister invented it, and we used to play it. And she once said about a couple we knew like 20 years ago, you know, he would hide us and she would turn us in. And it stayed with me because I really thought about that couple. And I thought, she is right. She has read them. And I, you know, it was, again, carried around for 20 years. And then I stepped back from it. The things that are right in front of you, it's a totally normal game to play for me, or normal way to think, or normal worldview. And I stepped back and saw that it's really deeply loaded and deeply emotional and very deeply twisted in its way, and I wanted to make it into a story. The point is, as the story built, as it was two couples, as it was a pantry, as the world took shape, I thought of another story that I deeply love. And with fiction, I mean, I write because I read. I love stories that I'm interested in the way we're talking about memory. And I think it's only fiction that turns into memory. You don't see a movie and think, when did that happen to me, and say, oh no, that was Al Pacino in Heat. You know, your memory doesn't work that way. But stories, I literally have, I don't even know how to explain it to you or the audience how intimate it is, but I literally can see in my head. I hadn't read the story. You said before we went on air that you're teaching this book this year. I'd love to hear last time you'd read it, but it has to be 15 years. I literally, the whole story had erased itself, or not erased itself, it had formed into what it's supposed to, which is memory. And I just had this picture of a table, like a round kitchen table, two couples, a bottle of gin, and the changing of
light.
So
it turns to vodka here, I think.
Yes, that's the switch, vodka and weed.
And Carver and weed. Well, a lot of weed in Carver too, particularly in Cathedral. But there's, he called it a platonic symposium, which is kind of heavy for a working class guy like Raymond Carver.
Yes.
But it is kind of a platonic symposium. And you bring that back to life. And the story has that profundity of the question, you know, who would betray and who would protect. But I mentioned the first paragraph because also embedded in that is, for me as a reader, the attitude that you're also playing with in here, the difference between Israeli Jews and American Jews, and Hasidic Israeli Jews at that,
yes,
let alone secular American Jews. And these are people who come together because the two women were friends when they were girls in high school. And now their lives have taken such a different fate. So there's that as well. There's even a story within a story, which is something that Carver was famous
yes.
for, about, you know, two survivors who meet and then one cuts in line called a cutter. I mean, the comedic is always in your work. And so even though this is a story about very serious issues, is comedy. I mean, when they're not only comedy, excuse me, but joy is what I meant to say. When they're out dancing in the rain, for example, and doing the hora, you've got so many elements going on in this story. It's a feast.
You're generous. I do believe, I mean, just, you know, talking about neurosis or worry or fear, I really do think fiction is about building a world, and another reason to love the short story. It's the same effort that goes into a novel in terms of world construction. You have to make a complete universe. And I think, I mean, I really never even disrespect fiction that I love by talking about it as a made up reality. Every, you know, we talk, it's the big fight. Is it creationism? Is it God? Is it, you know, evolution? Everything gets made up, including the world we're in now, you know? And my point is...
But this is your world. That's what I was struck by. This is Nathan Englander's world. It's like when Carver says, I create a world and, you know, you've mentioned Nabokov. I read Nabokov. It's Nabokov's world.
Yeah.
It's your world.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad if it turns... I mean, that's it, all... I can't step out of my head in that way, except that it's deeply important to me that it be a world. And that's why when you say, you know, the joy or the humor, I think however dark my stories get, which is pretty inevitable, they somehow take
away. Some of them do get dark, Nathan. I will make no bones about that with you. We'll talk about some of the other stories as well. At least I certainly hope we have time to talk about the stories, because let's talk about the one, for example, because you're essentially a realistic writer, and you take us into this peep show with this guy at 42nd Street, and suddenly, instead of women, he's seeing rabbis, and he's seeing his mother. I mean, the overladen sense of guilt is there. Some would call it magic realism. I call it fabulism, fabulous writing. But you allow your imagination to kind of go off into a completely different kind of realm than perhaps what you often do, which is realistic storytelling.
Yeah, that one, it's funny. I wrote most of the book in the last year. I mean, this is a lifetime worth of work for me. I don't know what's happened that I'm suddenly accessing story differently. I also am such a deep believer that a collection, I don't understand, there's the fake battles of our world, like stories versus novel. Experientially, I think when you read through a collection, they better not be cobbled together. You know what I'm saying? It better have this theme and this, you know, thematic arc to it. It really should be that complete experience. And in building this book, there were a couple of old stories that I pulled out of the past that I felt really belonged in here. And Peep Show was one. It was in the New Yorker like 12 years ago or something.
But what's the thematic essence that you feel is in this volume?
I think it, you know, in that story, we're talking about Peep Show, where it's this man who's now, you know, Alan Fine and was Avi Feinberg. You know, this idea, it's about identity and ownership of self and comfort with those decisions or discomfort with them. That's, you know, that's how with what we talk about the title story, where it's these people who were, you know, this guy's secular, now he's Hasidic, you know, regular Orthodox. And, you know, this idea of people taking on mantles, taking on definition and imposing them or receiving them. And that's the point where this guy who's changed his life ends up taking on the way home, walking into a peep show, and he puts the coin in, and the naked women turn into his old rabbis from school.
Again, talking with Nathan Englander, his new book is What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, collection of stories. There's also a story about anti-Semitism and these young boys who really don't know how to fight. They're in the suburbs. It takes on the colorings again of the Shoah and the Holocaust. This phantom figure, he may have even had Jewish blood in him. They used to say that about Hitler, too.
Yes, I remember hearing that when I was little. That was a big thing, everyone saying that he was adopted. It's such a strange... Speaking of pathologies, that's such a strange, strange thing.
Well, you know, what always came to my mind with that was Faulkner's Light in August, Joe Christmas. Uh-huh. There's always that doubt about whether he had Jewish blood in him.
Right.
He was a hater of black people. But there in that story, Masada suddenly comes into the story. And Masada is a kind of paradigm for Jewish history. Talk about that.
Yeah. And again, one of the opening night event I did at the New York Public Library, my hometown library, I feel very close. But I was going to talk about this story in a distant manner. And I looked out into the audience and I thought there were people who were at my bris here. You know, I looked the way you're, you know, local support. And I thought, and I just had to say, and I looked out, there were a number of people from my town of different ages who were in that audience. And it's a battle we had with the anti-Semites of our town. You know, it's hardly, you know, it's a very thinly veiled, unless you want to sue me for using your identity, then it's deeply veiled. But nonetheless, that was really a war we had. But about Masada, I spent all this time in Israel and I was a madrich, like a counselor once. So you take these kids up there, it's so moving. And the soldiers, different, you know, there's different sort of tasks when you finish your training for soldiers. And some groups go up to Masada and they scream off into this beautiful echo. Masada being the desert fortress, you know, this holdout against the Romans. And they scream out, you know, Shenit Masada lo tipol, like a second time Masada won't fall, you know, this great cry. And I just got to thinking about the story of Masada, what it is. For 3 years, the Romans are building this ramp up to get the Jews. And basically these rebels all kill themselves before they get
there. It's mass suicide.
Yeah, it's mass suicide. And I thought, wait, our greatest story, our greatest legendary story of battle readiness and gumption is that everybody killed themselves when the enemy was at the door. I thought this is needs some more thinking.
Well, you did some more thinking on it. There's also a story, you talk about the dark stories here. There's a story where these people are at a kind of bifurcated camp. There are kids on one side and there are elders on another side. And some of the elders think they've recognized a kind of Demjanjuk figure or a Nazi, even though he seems to be just a Jewish guy who, you know, ordinary Joe almost. And the camp counselor, the head of the camp, is very concerned about this. You've got a pedophile thrown in the story. I mean, it's quite a mix. But what I was struck by in that story, among many other things, was just a sense of scapegoating again. And it just keeps coming back in your work. I mean, in almost all these stories, and this gets pretty dark, as I said, you have an Israeli who goes back in another story and actually slays a whole family, including an infant, taking up the home that he's in, the German home that he lived in. It's like it's haunting you, I guess, isn't it? The Shoah.
Haunting's a very loaded word, but probably deeply accurate way to say it. I guess, you know, for me, the point is back to building worlds. Every read that is a smart, you know, that is a perfectly lovely read. But if you ask me, you know, there better be other facets that I'm not aware of when I'm building something. But for me, I'm just obsessed with the gray space and questions of morality. And, you know, this idea, you know, sort of like Demjanjuk when you see him on his bed, or even, you know, all these guys that are being held to trial. Well, you want to take Mubarak in Egypt, where you see these people rolled in, you know, this idea.
Even your anti-Semite, who I'm not going to spoil the story, but who becomes a boy at the end of the story. Boy about him.
Yeah. So it's this idea of like, of responsibility and how it moves through time and justice and who is to deliver it. And, you know, the world, I guess I can never get over the fact that the world is not a fair place. That's what I'm haunted by. Honestly. Yeah. I don't feel haunted by the Holocaust as an idea. I'm, you know, surely obsessed with ideas of it, but I'm truly haunted by the fact that the world is not more fair.
I was thinking about the psychoanalyst, Winnicott, who said, take your ghosts and turn them into ancestors. It's good advice. What do you think? I mean, there's a story here about settlements. Let's talk about settlements from your perspective, because there are many Jews, in fact, who view the settlements as totally wrong and even immoral.
Yeah, it's funny. My time in Israel has really helped me with understanding America, exactly what's happening now in American politics. I'm so used to it. The true embarrassment of what's happening now, you know, this idea of people claiming, you know, it's you learn to hear the double speaker in the reverse. I think the very idea, the person that I assume is the least patriotic these days is anyone who calls themselves a patriot. To me, that's almost a claim of saying I'm going to dismantle any sort of care for others or a social system or support. You know, it's this idea of people saying they want to help. You know, I don't believe in big government. Like, how little do you want it to get? It seems to me no government is what people, you know, it's this idea that claims we're headed towards socialism. I think we're headed, it seems to me, the you can say that as I'm a Democrat, but that's socialism. I think people are working towards feudalism. Super PACs to me are
F-U-T-I-L-E or F-U-E-U-D-A-L.
No, like feudal lords. I mean, it's this idea that you will be, you know, there will be a feudal king. And, you know, my point is I've learned all this in Israel about giving an inch and giving up power and people making claims and using the Bible. I know the Bible well, and most of the stuff I hear people – most of the people who are waving a Bible around claiming that we need to follow things in the Bible, I don't think are reading the same Bible as me. The book is really close to my heart. You know, but my point is I could get really, really political about Israel, and I have unbelievably strong feelings about the settlements. But what I want to say about the story is that the challenge for me in this story was – which is, I feel, in every story. But this one, that was – they all have dominant challenges in the construction of them. And construction makes it sound cold. It's a wholly emotional, vulnerable, naked construction. So, but that idea in building the story and keeping my obligation to the story itself, I literally did not know what I had. I've never, in nothing else, yes, I pull out my hair and go crazy when I'm writing them. That's a whole, I'll say neurotic yet again, but a very neurotic, loaded process. But in this one, when I finished the story, I literally did not sleep that night. You know what I'm saying? And that's the point of things I don't know why. I don't even want to – because this story is out and in this book now, I don't even want to weigh in on what I think about the settlements. But,
well, why don't you weigh in on something else? I'd like to know your opinion about what's become almost gender apartheid in Israel. I mean, the health minister receives an award and they have to have a man go up for her. Women can't get on buses now or have to go to the back of the bus like Rosa Parks.
This is my point is I believe democracy – I believe that democracy works, that it can work, that under – this is my point – under an American democracy, like, you can have your total religious freedom. The idea is it doesn't work the other way. You know, there's no theo-democracy is not going to work. You know, we're having this birth control fight now in the States, like this idea of the amount of government funding that goes into these places. My point is you don't want to do these things and opt out. You know, it's this idea of other people. What happens in this country is that idea. It's happening now where you say freedom. I'm pro-freedom, and part of freedom means being part of a society. I'm not free to kill my neighbor if I'm in the mood to. That's wrong. And it's this idea. If you'd like to be part of larger society, there are certain basic rules that need to be respected. I have no problem with their own privately funded buses. You can't do it on a public bus. And, you know, this idea, you can't spit on a woman because you don't like the way she dresses. And I think that's an interesting thing. You know, they have, you know, that I've been yelled at many times, you know, walking through their neighborhood, you know, in Jerusalem with my long hair and, you know, you're not welcome there. And it's interesting if you want garbage pickup and you want the sewer to work and you want police presence, you know, there are certain basic rules if you are going to be part of a society. So my point is your own bus, do whatever you want. That's the beautiful thing about democracies. Do whatever you want, but you have to recognize you are part of a larger society.
When the ultra-Orthodox, some of them put on yellow stars to show that.
Yeah, I've been, you bring up that image, you know, back to haunting. I've been talking about that, and I always qualify,
Well, let me just frame it, right, because I think some listeners may not know what we're talking about here. They wanted to show that they were being victimized by the Israeli government. With the laying down of laws that said don't impose your religious views on, you know, don't spit at young girls because they're dressed a certain way or throw stones at them and so forth. And they wore yellow stars to show that they were like those Jews who were victimized in the Holocaust.
And this is, I mean, that's, I can't, I'm so glad you raised it. I'm obsessed with that image. I've torn it, I saved it digitally. I have the page torn out of the Times because I love me a physical paper. But that to me, you know, I guess I think about it because I write stories, and this idea, I feel like we pick the wrong battles often. And it's that idea that people be like, how can you address in fiction the ideas of the Holocaust? People always want to get upset about writing and stuff. I think you have to look at people's hearts, stuff that's good, done with good intent. You know, the idea of wanting to pick a fight with me or to go back, like to want to be upset at Philip Roth for Ghostwriter, some idea. That is such a beautiful book and a beautiful exploration of the idea.
Also about Anne Frank.
Of Anne Frank, yeah. You know what I'm saying? That's wonderful stuff. But to me, when I thought about it, when I thought about what happens, the pathology and the memory of the Holocaust. And again, we must qualify for your audience. This is not all Hasidim. It's a tiny, this was a group of people like any other group of people, you know, just one small, tiny group who went out to the street to protest in that way. But to me, when I thought about people questioning, you know, this idea, I almost feel like there's like a, It's like the Simon Wiesenthal Center for hunting people who betray the idea of the Holocaust. You know, people are hunting through books to look to be offended when they're written with a good heart. I think you can tell when something's written with a good heart. So my point is just, I think that is the greatest, honestly, betrayal of the memory of the Holocaust for Jews to use that star in that way to me. Because I don't – even soccer hooligans putting their arms up, I feel like that's out of ignorance. It's not – for people who know and to live in this country that rose out of the ashes of the Holocaust and to live as Hasidim, to have the weight of history and put on those stars was, to me, the single greatest disrespect I've ever seen to the memory of the Holocaust.
And how about some of the extreme Jews who went off to Iran and met with Ahmadinejad and said there was no Holocaust? I mean, when you're talking about extreme sex –
That's the Neturei Karta, yes. Yeah. He's like the official rabbi of Iran, that guy. I've seen him in the old, I don't know if he's still the one, but I used to see him in Mea Shearim in that neighborhood.
Well, he said the Messiah hadn't come, obviously, so Israel couldn't exist, right? You couldn't have a Zionist state without the Messiah.
Yeah, well, this is the point of like people using government to dismantle. You know, it's a really strange thing in Israel. There's so many people who are, you know, the Chazim who are groups of them who literally don't believe in the state. You're not, yes, that the state itself is not valid.
When you were talking about the heart, though, I was struck by something. Well, Faulkner in his Nobel, I didn't realize I'd be mentioning Faulkner twice in this hour with you, Nathan, but
yes.
Faulkner in his Nobel speech said great art comes from the heart against itself, as you probably know. And I thought that's what you were doing in this opening story, this title story in some respects. I mean, you have, on the one hand, a kind of argument that's probably an ongoing Jewish argument, as well as other religions and other peoples. One side saying you can't be Jewish without the religion. You can't forsake the religion. It's ethical monotheism. It goes back thousands of years. And the other group saying the Holocaust. We're obsessed with the Holocaust. And that's what we've sort of almost replaced religion with. It's become a kind of sacred trust for us to constantly remind ourselves and give deference to the Holocaust.
Yeah, I think that's it. I'm interested in ownership of ideas, like this idea of people, you know, saying, I'm the one, how can you write this? I'm the defender. And I was like, and how can you defend, who are, you know, who is everyone to take ownership of ideas? But the heart of the, what you're talking about to me is, you know,
there's an essential split there. There's a bifurcation within Jewish identity.
Yes. And my brain is bifurcated in that way. That's the point. I've lived many sides of Jewish experience. And for me, I grew up, Judaism was a religion. There was no such thing as saying I'm Jewish and I'm not kosher. I just didn't even, couldn't comprehend that as a child. And to me, I'm really interested in that line of what, you know, who, like, what is a Jew? What is it? What is culture versus religion? Where do those things meet?
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum from our archives. Our guest was writer Nathan Englander. He discussed his recent collection of short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum up ahead, and Happy New Year.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.